I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. On this day honoring Martin Luther King, there are a few people I would want to talk with more than Leonard Pitts Jr. This year, the Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the Miami Herald wants us to recall the leader of the civil rights movement as the man he was in the time he was. We'll look at how Dr. King's image has changed in a decade since his assassination, and we'll explore what he would make of our country today. I'll ask Pitts his thoughts on President Trump and race, and whether Americans are really as inclusive as we would like to think. Later, a review of KU and Mizzou basketball with Greg Eklund. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Nationally syndicated columnist and Pulitzer winner Leonard Pitts Jr. has this thought about Martin Luther King Jr. He wants to unencrust him. By that, Pitts means that King should be recognized today not as a sanitized deity, but in a more complicated way, as a dangerous man in a dangerous time. That was the message that Leonard Pitts delivered last week in a visit to Kansas City. He's an author, novelist, and a columnist for the Miami Herald, and he's here with us today on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day. He joins us from NPR Studios in Washington. And Leonard, welcome back to Up to Date. Always good to have you here.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
I want to focus on Dr. King today and your thoughts about him, but I'd be remiss in not asking you about the story dominating the headlines today, and that's President Trump's comments on his own views on race. The president is insisting that he's not a racist. In fact, he told reporters in West Palm Beach, Florida, that he's the least racist person you have ever interviewed. You buy that?
No. It's funny because when I saw that quote, which he has uttered before, I was reminded of an email, a letter I received once from a reader. His name was J.D. He said, "My name is J.D. and I'm a racist." And most people will not admit this. And J.D. is to this day the only racist I know who has ever held his hand up and said,
I'm a racist. Yeah.
And perversely, I have a certain amount of respect for J.D. for being able to see himself clearly enough. And it's a clarity that obviously Donald Trump lacks. He is a racist. He was obviously a racist long before he made the unfortunate comment last week about Haiti, El Salvador, and the continent of Africa. This is just those comments are just the extra, the superfluous, the icing on a very ugly cake, if you will. But, you know, it doesn't add anything new. It just reinforces what we, those of us who are paying attention at least, should have already known.
You know, is the nation responding appropriately to the president and the things he says, including what you just alluded to, Leonard, and those comments last week about some countries being highly undesirable places to live?
I think the nation is exhausted, many of us. I think that he has exhausted our capacity for paying attention, and maybe, although it pains me to say this, our capacity for outrage. I was looking on Twitter just before we came on air, and I read a tweet that really kind of stuck with me. I can't say who it was from, but this individual noted that last week came news that the president of the United States, right before the election, made a payoff to a porn star.
Right.
And it's a one-day story.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, can you imagine 2 years ago or during the Bush 1 or Bush 2 or Clinton or Reagan or anybody, can you imagine that as a one-day story?
Well, there's a danger to this idea, though, isn't there, that if we're exhausted by this behavior, which you and so many others describe as highly inappropriate, if we're not responding to it in a forceful way, are we asking for it?
I think we're at a minimum, if we're not asking for it, we're enabling it, we're allowing it, we are lowering the bar for whomever it is that comes into office after this individual. And that, to me, is the frightening thing. The rules have been changed, the goal lines the goalposts have been moved with regard to this president in terms of what's acceptable. Last week, newspapers around the country, newspapers of record, found themselves not for the first time in the Trump era using language that you would never have expected to find, in the Washington Post or the New York Times or whatever. I mean, the goalposts of propriety of what is acceptable are being moved, are being downgraded by this individual, and that I don't know that you get that back, and that's a little scary.
So what should we be doing? What should we newspaper people be doing to counter what's happening here?
I don't know that there's a whole lot that we can do that we're not doing. I was asked this question last week when I spoke for the SCLC on Martin Luther King for Martin Luther King Day. A reporter asked, "What should we be doing?" And my response was that, well, if you'd asked me this 10 years ago, I would have talked about the need for more fact checking to be a part of our mission. But since then, you have PolitiFact, you have Snopes, you have newspapers beefing up their fact checking obligations. So the only thing that I can think of that as newspapers and news media in general we need to do is to be more forthright in calling this what it is. I think there is still some hesitation on that part. You saw some outlets still referring to the words that the president uttered last week as, I think, racially charged or racially incendiary. No one wants to make the judgment and say, no, this is actually racist. Some of us still have trouble with that. But other than that, I think that most of what we can do, we are doing.
Nationally syndicated columnist and Pulitzer winner Leonard Pitts Jr. is my guest on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day today. You had a problem when President Trump's, with his recent tribute to Rosa Parks, you called it an empty tribute, and I'm wondering why. Remind us what he did.
They produced this very slick video of Trump paying homage to Rosa Parks, and every word in it was was true, and it was a nicely produced. But you've got to consider the source. Donald Trump honoring Rosa Parks, or for that matter, Donald Trump honoring Martin Luther King, as he did a day or two ago, is analogous to Adolf Hitler announcing Jewish Appreciation Day. Again, consider the source. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump has less than no standing. He has negative numbers standing to pretend to honor the things that Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King did, especially when he stands in opposition to what they stood for, and indeed is in some cases and in some ways trying with all that he has in him to roll those things back.
You've even gone further than that, Leonard. You said that Trump would have led the mob against Rosa Parks rather than giving up his seat for her.
Of course he would have. I probably said that in conjunction with responding to a reader who assured me that had Rush Limbaugh been on that bus that December day in 1955, he would have stood up and insisted that Rosa Parks take his seat. And so, there's an appalling level of self-delusion among some folks in terms of the civil rights movement, in terms of anti-racism fights, that I just find really difficult to countenance. Donald Trump is, in a nutshell, what Martin Luther King and what Rosa Parks and what all the sung and unsung heroes and heroines of the civil rights movement, he is what they were fighting against, this sort of sense of entitlement. I consider him sort of almost an affirmative action president, at least in the negative sense that affirmative action is sometimes used, in which a supposedly unqualified individual, you make excuses for his or her lapses. If that's the definition that some people would go with, then he certainly meets that. He's unfit, unqualified, every un that you can that you can think of. So I don't see where the confusion lies with some folks.
How confident are you that this year there will be a backlash registered against the president at the polls in November? Is this going to be the kind of year that voters send a strong message to the president?
I believe there's going to be a backlash. The only question is what will the size be? Will how big will this be? How much will it roll back? And then again, how much will that mean? Because one of the distinguishing characteristics of this last year, 2 years of Donald Trump, is that the normal rules of political gravity do not apply. Mm-hmm. The things that would have sunk any number of other presidential candidates do not apply, because what we're talking about when we're talking about the supporters of Donald Trump is not people who have made a calculation that I believe what he believes, therefore I will support him. Their calculation is he represents and embodies my resentments. Therefore, I will support him. And that kind of support, I think, is much less is going to be much less responsive to the normal political ups and downs that would sink or uplift another candidate or president.
Columnist Leonard Pitts Jr. is my guest. His latest column appears in today's Kansas City Star. You also just wrote that one of your problems with Trump, Leonard, is that he's got nothing to say. What did you mean by that he's got nothing to say?
Well, it's funny. Right before, during the campaign that brought Barack Obama to office, there was some complaint that he was simply eloquent, but that there was nothing behind it. And the thing that struck me from that is that eloquence is a tool in the presidential arsenal. The ability to move people by the power of your words and the poetry of your words and the uplift of your words is very much an important thing. And in that sense, Donald Trump is there is no there. I don't know how many political cartoons I've seen juxtaposing quotes from various presidents, from Ronald Reagan to Lincoln to John F. Kennedy to whomever, with whatever the latest asinine thing is that Trump has said. And it's really frightening. I have a bias here because I'm a writer, so I'm really sort of attuned to the use and abuse of language. But I have this conviction that the ability to use language in an orderly way and in an uplifting way reflects a certain orderliness of thought and of mind.
Yeah.
And by that standard, what can you say about Donald Trump, especially even, and this is not just his spoken language, even his written language, i.e. his tweets, betrays this. I noted when the tweet that he sent out ultimately denying that he had said what he said last week about Haiti and the nations of Africa, if you read that tweet, he first confirms and then denies what he said within the context of a single sentence. That's an amazingly poor use of language for anybody, much less for somebody who is the titular leader of the free world.
Let's get our listeners involved here. The question on the table here is, how should the nation be responding to comments like the ones from President Trump last week about other nations? What should be our collective response? Our phone number here, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Our guest again, nationally syndicated columnist Leonard Pitts Jr. Well, let's turn to Dr. King himself, Leonard, because you said last week in Kansas City that the Dr. King who scared the hell out of people is the Dr. King who has the most to tell us. What did you mean by that?
What I meant is that what's happened to Martin Luther King has happened to every great man or woman once they pass from the scene, once they become safely dead. We have this tendency to entomb them in marble and to place them on pedestals where they are out of reach of the people who need them most.
Which arguably we've done literally out in Washington, right?
Literally, and it's funny you should say that because I just drove by that monument on the way to the studio.
Wow!
It happened with King. It's happened with other great men and women, but the problem is that the fight that King led is still ongoing in very real and substantive ways. So we cannot afford to have him placed at a distance from us. We cannot afford to not understand in a very real and substantive way what he did and how he did and why he did, if only because, not simply for inspiration, but if only for a guidepost, a guidebook for us to fight our stage of the struggle here in 2018.
You describe him as a dangerous man in a dangerous time. Why?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because what Martin Luther King did was he was a threat to the status quo, which had existed for, depending on, which aspect of the status quo we're talking about, existed for the better part of a century. And he was a guy who was upending the status quo, who was threatening the status quo. And what was perhaps most remarkable slash galling, depending upon your political ideology at the time, is that he was using America's own words and ideals and professions of its national core beliefs against it. This doesn't get quoted very much, but one of Dr. King's favorite lines, one of my favorite lines of Dr. King's, rather, is from his last speech, where he said, "All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper." Now, that's not his most elegant or poetic line, but there's a heck of a lot of truth and moral authority in that. Because if America ever had or ever did or was now being true to what it said on paper, many of the arguments, debates, discussions, and crises and problems that we have today, we would not have.
You know, it's interesting to me what a roundly unpopular man Dr. King was when he died. In fact, yeah. In 1967, get these numbers, just 32% of Americans viewed him positively, while 63% viewed him negatively. Those are almost Trumpian numbers. What do you make of it?
Yeah, and similar. I've seen similar numbers, and what you didn't quote there is that the majority of African Americans also viewed him unfavorably.
Wow!
And the fact is that a lot of that came because Dr. King had begun speaking out against the war on Vietnam. I believe he actually first spoke out in 65 or 66. I'm blanking on which year, but he had been speaking out against the war in Vietnam at a time when there was still great controversy over that war. Now, obviously, history proved him to be right on the money. With his critique of the war, but at the time, his opinion, his disavowal of the war, was very easily caricatured as, sympathy for the communists or hating America or some such other terminology that was used to shut him down.
That's interesting. Let's go to some phone calls here for Leonard Pitts Jr. Let's go to Rick from Paola, Kansas. Rick, good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, and thank you for having this. It's a whole discussion. One of the things I find most distressing about the whole Trump climate that he has created and the destruction of the republic that he is bringing on is the complete inaction and complete lack of comment on this by our quote unquote elected representatives, namely Jenkins, Moran, and Roberts. And you know, when I call their offices in D.C., it's just. Robert's office, their people are just flat arrogant. The others are just like, well, they will never answer a question. But how I can get emails from those people saying, oh, we went and visited this and that, so then the people came by and visited in the office, and they never, ever address the issues that Trump raises daily. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Rick. Leonard, what would you recommend to someone like Rick who wants to engage, it sounds like, in some kind of dialogue with his representatives in Washington, and he's not getting much back?
I would suggest that he make it his job to us whenever the next election is to find new representatives. But I do share his frustration because one of the most troubling aspects of this whole thing has been the complete abandonment of any kind of moral compass from virtually every Republican lawmaker, at least on the national level. I don't have words to tell you how disappointed I am that these folks, some of whom proudly said, quote unquote, never Trump, how disappointed I am that these folks are sort of making common cause or bending themselves, I guess, to be able to support him. It's just amazing, and it really does not speak well of them or of the party, frankly. You know, it makes people like Jeff Flake and Bob Corker, et cetera, who have stood up against him. It makes them stand out all the more, or John McCain. And people, when I say that, liberals will tell me, well, yeah, they disagree, but these people have voted with him all the time, and they disagree with you on most of the things that you would want. Yeah, that's fine. That's politics. Mm-hmm. I understand that. But the dimension of Trump that appalls me is not simply the political. It is the personal. It is the ineptitude, the incompetence, the coarseness of this man. And I'm glad to see anybody, particularly anybody with an R after their name, stand up and acknowledge the obvious.
Let's go back to some phone calls here. Al from Kansas City, Missouri. You're on with Leonard Pitts Jr. Al, good morning.
Good morning. Wow, Leonard Pitts knows how to talk. He knows how to say it. There's so much here, but ultimately, you know, Martin Luther King wasn't a saint. He was an honest man, and he was a politician as well. But the thing we have to remember, especially in this horrible time that we're in, is that ultimately history shows that good ultimately defeats this kind of stuff. Unfortunately, in the Nazi era, people didn't participate, and that goes to Eldridge Cleaver's quote, which is a great quote. If you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. And I'm a first-generation Holocaust survivor, and I will tell you that people did what they're doing right now, and look what happened. So this can happen again, and it can happen here, and we really have to make an active choice in our politics and in our conversation with each other. Don't be afraid to say what is true, because it wins. Ultimately, the good wins over evil, but it can be pretty messy in between. And I think we need to look at that and start getting very active and changing the game in November.
Al, thank you. Appreciate that. And
sure,
Leonard, I couldn't help but think, Leonard, as he was speaking about King's quote about the arc of the moral universe ultimately bends towards justice.
Yeah, that I was thinking the exact same thing. I was also thinking of a trip that I took to Auschwitz, to a number of Holocaust sites in 2005. With a Holocaust survivor, a guy who actually escaped from the death train, leaving Auschwitz, and when Trump came to when Trump began to rise to power, there were a number of us, and I was among them, who began to notice disturbing parallels with the rise to power of the German Chancellor Hitler. And this is a comparison that you are loath to make because you don't want to seem to be trivializing the Holocaust. Nobody thinks that Trump is going to put people on rail cars and take them to be gassed or anything like that. But yet and still, these parallels exist. And I kind of hesitated to write about these things. But then I start seeing Holocaust survivors, actual people who've actually gone through this, saying the exact same thing, including, as I recall, the stepsister of Anne Frank. Mm-hmm. And my feeling was, who has more moral authority to call this than they do? So yeah, there's something very much redolent of Germany in the 1930s in America in 2018, and part of it is, as the caller pointed out, the fact that people who should be saying something are either poo-pooing it or going along with it, however they're doing it, empowering it and allowing it to happen, as opposed to standing up and saying, "Hey, wait a minute, this is not who we are supposed to be."
Let's do this. Let's take a short break. I'm overdue here for one, Leonard. When we get back, we'll continue our very good conversation with Leonard Pitts Jr. Kathy and Gail, hang on. We'll get your calls when I get back. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. On Friday's show, we discussed and heard some of the best local music of the year. Hear my conversation with our panel of musical connoisseurs at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, prolific composer and pianist Marcus Roberts is on the show. Roberts taught himself to play piano at a young age. After losing his sight when he was just 5 years old, he plays in Kansas City on Friday night. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, this hour, we're visiting with Leonard Pitts Jr. He's a nationally syndicated columnist. He's a winner of a Pulitzer Prize. He writes for McClatchy newspapers, and he's been on the show before. He joins us on this National Martin Luther King Jr. Day. You know, it's been amazing to me, Leonard, to watch the public image of Colin Kaepernick, the former 49ers quarterback who famously protested by kneeling during the national anthem. Do you regard Colin Kaepernick as, you know, as anywhere close to a civil rights icon like Rosa Parks?
Well, it's funny you should mention that. As you will probably recall, I mentioned Kaepernick in the column that you referenced earlier about Trump's honoring Rosa Parks. Here's the thing about Colin Kaepernick. I don't know what he will become, and he obviously has yet to achieve a fraction of the impact on our society as Rosa Parks, much less Martin Luther King Jr. But those who dismiss him out of hand, and they're eager to do so as a showboat or as a guy who's only in it for himself, or he's dishonoring the military, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, miss the fact that he is acting very much in the mold of Dr. King and of Rosa Parks. This gets back to what I meant. You mentioned my quote about entombing people in great men and women in marble and sort of putting them on pedestals to make them inaccessible. What Kaepernick is doing, or has done, and it's inspired other football players to do, is precisely no more, no less than what Rosa Parks did. And we forget that when Rosa Parks did this, she wasn't Rosa Parks, you know, boldface name in history. She was an anonymous 42-year-old seamstress in Montgomery, Alexander, Alabama, excuse me, and NAACP secretary, and just a lady who said, I got tired of going along essentially with my own being degraded. And so in that sense, there's a direct line and a direct correlation between what she did and what Kaepernick did a year, 2 years ago. So that's part of why I was upset with Mr. Trump for purporting to honor her. You can't honor her and then turn around and call Kaepernick and other football players who choose to kneel during the national anthem SOBs for essentially doing the same thing. When you get right down to it, at a very literal sense, they both did exactly the same thing. They saw injustice and they literally refused to stand for it.
Yeah. You know, it seems to me we're having these defining moments as a culture these days. You know, broad segments of society are learning that we're maybe not as inclusive on race as we thought we once were. We're learning that women have been victimized continually for far longer than many of us had understood. Is that a reason for optimism sort of tucked in somewhere there?
I suppose it is. I guess maybe I'm just a pessimistic guy, but
you're a newspaper guy, Leonard.
Yeah, so yeah. I guess I'm entitled. I see a reason for optimism, but the thing that I also see that I don't think people are really understanding, you know, when we look back at, you know, I mentioned the Holocaust before, we look back at how ordinary Germans behaved during that era. They didn't cover themselves with glory. We look back on how the White South behaved during the segregation years. They didn't cover themselves with glory. And people always talk about how, well, this is what I would have done, you know. This is how I would have behaved. I can't see how they did this. If I had been there, I would have done this, that, and the other. Well, guess what? This is your moment. Mm-hmm. This is your moment right now, right at this moment in 2018, as these great struggles for human dignity are going on. You and I and everybody listening to this, we are posing for history. Mm-hmm. We are, you know, getting our picture together, our image together for what people are going to say about us in this moment 20, 30, 40 years from now. And frankly, a lot of the people that I see are posing for history very poorly, shall we say. I look at you know, the senators who are and congresspersons who are enabling Donald Trump, knowing what it is that he stands for. I look at the people who are blasting Colin Kaepernick and purporting to honor Rosa Parks and doing so very disingenuously and trying to claim that he has some brief or some animus against the U.S. military or the flag, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You're posing for history. The books, you're writing the history books, and right now you don't look so good.
Let's go to Gail from Basser, Kansas. Gail, good morning.
Good morning. And first, I know there are so many people waiting to talk to you. Thank your guest. I hope he comes back at least once a week, because there are thousands of people out there who want to get through, who want to wait and get through, but you just need to have more shows like this. This is just an outlet for so many people. First, I would hope that Mr. Robert Mueller stays safe. I want him to work cautiously, but I also would love to see him work faster. Second, I am 75 years old. I remember Eisenhower, and this is the first time in my entire life I'm embarrassed to be an American. With our relationships overseas with England and all the countries that we've embarrassed by our president, I just the words fail me, really. And I know there are so many people out there that feel the same way. I can't even begin to count. But I would really, truly love to see more people on your show that are talking openly about this situation in honest English.
Right. Gail, I appreciate the phone call. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Leonard, you didn't know you were going to have to make a commitment to be on the show weekly as a result of coming on today. And I want you to know how much I appreciate that. Kathy from Kansas City, Missouri. Kathy, you're on with Leonard Pitts, Jr. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. I just wanted to say I heard a beautiful sermon this morning from Math, calling Dr. Martin Luther King the prophet of common sense. And listening to his, you know, goodness will overcome evil. And I believe that. But I think that people need to take a stand now. They need to call out the Republican representatives that are in Congress and the Senate and say that they're no better than Trump and what he does. If they feel that Trump is, you know, casting evil and doing all these bad things, they need to help stop him. And I wish that everyone would write their congressmen and their senators and tell them that they're complicit if they don't stand up against his vulgarity and his thoughts.
Right. Kathy, thanks for the call.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, appreciate it. William from Overland Park. William, good morning.
Good morning. I'm sorry. I just don't understand how you can be calling Trump a racist. I don't see the evidence for it. And with this last situation on, you know, what did he say about Haiti and so forth, that's been disputed by other Republicans that were in on the same meeting. Are you careful to say he may or may not have said this? No, it's reported as, no, that's what he said. And, I mean, Trump has done a lot. He's done a lot for African-American unemployment rate is at its lowest rate that it's been in tens of years.
Right.
I just don't understand just throwing out he's just like Hitler and all this sort of stuff. I just don't get it.
Okay, William, I appreciate that. Leonard, respond to him if you would.
Oh, please. Thank you very much. In terms of the Trump's bona fides as a racist, 1973, I believe it was, the first of two lawsuits for federal housing discrimination where Trump's companies did not allow African-Americans to buy or rent into his properties. Mr. Trump also is quoted by one of his biographers as saying that he didn't want black people counting his money. He preferred short guys with yarmulkes. Blacks were inherently lazy. It wasn't anything that they could help. It was just something that was in the genetics. Mr. Trump took off on a racist crusade against the so-called Central Park Five, five young men who were railroaded into jail for a crime that of rape in Central Park, the Central Park jogger case that they did not commit. Mr. Trump to this day refuses to acknowledge that he was wrong in calling for the death penalty for those young men, even though they had been exonerated by DNA, and on and on and on. And, you know, I shouldn't make this just an African-American thing. There's also racism in Mr. Trump's claim that a judge was unqualified to hear a case against him because the judge was Mexican-American, and et cetera, and et cetera. He has tweeted racist and sexist and Islamophobic memes ad infinitum. And then you add to that this latest comment on the nations of Africa, on Haiti and El Salvador. I'm sorry, you don't understand how I can call him a racist. I don't understand at this point how anyone can willfully not see. There's not a little bit of evidence. There is a tower of evidence. And the fact that someone chooses not to see that says more about that person or those people than it does about the quality of the evidence itself.
Now, we just have you for a few more minutes, Leonard. I was curious if you can give us a little peek into how you do the work that you do. How do you come up with your ideas? You write two columns a week, and give us a little sense of the Leonard Pitts process, if there is such a thing. Because as a fellow columnist, sometimes you wonder if you have a process. Yeah.
It's become a different process since January of last year. Ordinarily, it's a matter of grazing. I call it grazing, looking at every news source that I can find, also looking over, frankly, you know, what's going on in my own life and trying to find something that, as I like to put it, sticks on the wheels, the gears of the brain. You're looking for something that is not just necessarily in the news or newsworthy, but something that fires up something personal in you, something that you have a vested interest in, something that you feel that you can either, a subject where you feel you can either say something that has not been said or say it in a way that it is not being said. So, you know, I never write a column just because a subject, or seldom write a column just because the subject is in the news. I usually write a column because it's something that I feel very strongly personally that I have to say something about this.
What kind of feedback do you get?
A lot, probably about 1,000 emails a week, and that's
wow.
That's the normal mode of feedback these days.
You respond to all those?
I wish I could. We respond. I have an assistant, myself and Judy Smith, and we respond to as many as we can. Those that, you know, that write a book under the guise of an email are less likely to, you know, to get a response. And there are a lot of people that simply write looking to pick a fight or to you know, say something, to curse or to say something dumb, and, you know, they're less likely to get a response. The kind that I most treasure, and these are incredibly rare, and maybe it's incredibly rare for you also, are the ones that can dissent from whatever it is that you've said, but do so in a thoughtful, intelligent,
yes,
and logically coherent way that makes you have to go back and rethink what you wrote. That happens so rarely. That's you know, that's such a rare thing, but when that happens, I'm very pleased.
Well, that's Leonard Pitts Jr. Leonard, I sure appreciate you taking time on this important Martin Luther King Jr. Day. You're always welcome here, and I sure appreciate the time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Bet. Well, you heard Leonard Pitts' thoughts on Dr. King, but we wondered what springs to mind when Kansas Cityans think of Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Here to help us out with that is KCUR's Michelle Tyreen Johnson. And Michelle, welcome. Nice to have you here.
Hey, Steve.
You went out to gather some local voices. Where did you go?
I went to the Gym Theater last week when they had a special screening of the movie I Am Not Your Negro, which was about James Baldwin.
Yeah.
So that was great because there was a lot of people there.
Down in the 18th and Vine District, right?
Yes, yes.
Did you have any expectations of what you might hear there?
Well, you know, I knew I was going, frankly, to a captive audience when it came to what the topic was, because chances are, if you were going to that screening, and I knew that it was sold out, that it had been sold out days in advance, that there are people who were already primed to care about the issues and the topic of how they were going to spend Martin Luther King Jr. Day.
Okay. Well, let's take a listen to what people had to say about Dr. King and this holiday today.
It has different meanings as the time goes on past his, you know, his assassination, but we are still needing to honor his service and then give back ourselves.
It's being minimized, and it's more celebration. It's more about a holiday rather than really taking an in-depth look that which people give you can be taken away.
If you have a platform, then you have a personal responsibility to say something. And so, like, there's no excuses not to keep that going.
The fight, the struggle, what he stood for, I think that's what it is that we celebrate, because he paved the way for so many. And even though his legacy was cut short, his time was cut short, he made a huge impact that has lasted forever.
Michelle, who did we just hear there?
That was Jesse Love, Betty Blackman, Astrid Madrell, and Cotton Campbell.
Okay. And what did you make of their answers there?
Well, what I think is interesting about Martin Luther King Jr. Day is that I think it's probably the only holiday / commemoration in America we have where there's a pretty tight correlation between what it's supposed to be and how people who celebrate it spend it.
Yeah.
A lot of holidays and celebrations end up becoming diluted.
Yeah. I was struck by the one reaction there that the importance of King Day has been minimized, particularly in the wake of, you know, all the conversation we just had with Leonard Pitts Jr. in the wake of Trump's presidency. You wonder if that's really the case.
I think it depends on who you are. For some people, it means a lot. For others, it's just part of a 3-day weekend. I mean, it's just another holiday, and people don't really care why they got off. They're just off. And that's, I think, what people mean when they say it's become minimized.
Yeah. Okay, we'll leave it there. That's reporter Michelle Tyreen Johnson. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Steve.
Coming up next, sports with Greg Eklund. Men's college basketball this weekend featured down-to-the-wire finishes for a few Big 12 and SEC teams, and an area women's basketball team is quietly making a national impact, which could be a factor in the upcoming NCAA Women's Basketball Regional, which is in Kansas City. Here to fill us in on those stories is KCUR sports contributor Greg Eklund. And Greg, it's always good to have you here. Happy Monday
to you.
Good
morning, Steve. Happy Monday to you.
First, on the men's side, the Kansas Jayhawks are trying for a record-breaking 14th straight regular season Big 12 championship. You almost can't believe it. This year could be a really big challenge, though. How so?
Well, the other teams are really good, Steve.
And there's a bunch of them, too.
There are a bunch of them, and we're going to see a good matchup tonight when Kansas has to travel to West Virginia. That's two ranked teams playing each other, two teams that are among the four that are tied for the Big 12 lead right now.
West Virginia, the number two ranked team in the country, ahead of even KU right now.
Right. Well, number two, pending the rankings that are going to come out this week, because West Virginia lost over the weekend to Texas Tech.
Right.
Nevertheless, and Texas Tech is another one of the co-leaders in the Big 12 Conference, along with Oklahoma. And Oklahoma plays at K-State tomorrow night.
What kind of ball game do you expect this evening?
Well, it should be a wild one.
Yeah.
Because KU is right now in a state of flux. Their depth has been questionable. They got a little bit of relief over the weekend with the addition of Silvio DeSouza. They're still waiting on the return of Billy Preston. They're really going into a hornet's nest in Morgantown.
It always is, right?
Yes, it is.
Tell us about Billy Preston and all the hubbub there, because a lot of folks see him as something of a KU basketball savior. Tell us about him.
Well, his physical stature, for one, makes people think that way, because he's 6'10". And Udoka Azubuki is someone who is also a 7-footer and has an imposing presence on the front line, but he needs a little help. And that's where the Jayhawks are thin. And that's where DeSouza and the addition of DeSouza helps out on that front line. You have to remember that Azubuki didn't start playing basketball until he moved to the U.S. from Nigeria when he was in the ninth grade, and then he played only 11 games last year because he injured his wrist and was lost for the rest of the season.
So why isn't the much ballyhooed Billy Preston playing? What's the issue there?
Well, the issue is an on-campus accident that he was involved in back in November. So the university, because of a question over the ownership of the vehicle that he was driving, conducted its own internal investigation. The university has concluded its investigation. It has turned over its results over to the NCAA, and now KU is awaiting the results of the NCAA's findings on KU's investigation.
Do we know what KU's investigation turned up?
We don't, and it probably won't come up until a ruling is decided on this.
So much hanging in the balance. This determines whether we get Billy Preston for this season or not, then.
Very much so, and could be, you know, down the stretch, an important factor for KU as it tries to seek that 14th straight regular season championship.
But again, you just pointed out we did get a little bit of help over this last weekend, then.
We did. DeSouza played 4 minutes in the game against Kansas State. He graduated from IMG Academy in Florida and arrived in Lawrence last month and played 4 minutes in the game because his eligibility was just favorably ruled upon over the weekend, so he got in a little bit of stint. It's going to take him a while, though, to adjust.
Did it look like it?
It did, yeah.
You could tell.
It looked like he was overwhelmed.
Okay. Well, on Saturday, Kansas State took KU down to the wire again, but couldn't win again. What happened there?
Boy, this one will frustrate Kansas State fans for a long time. They had 15 seconds, and Barry Brown got up a shot just with a second left, had plenty of time to score and pull out a win in Lawrence, and they were just not able to do it.
Seems to me this is 2 years in a row in Lawrence where K-State fell just a little, well, fell a little bit short.
Of course, last year the K-State fans will remind you of the non-traveling call when Svi went up for the layup against K-State.
So again, remind us who's challenging KU in the Big 12 this year, because as you've pointed out, there's a slew of teams there who are coming at KU hard.
Right. We mentioned the two co-leaders playing tonight, and then Oklahoma playing at K-State tomorrow as another co-leader. The team that has really raised eyebrows is Texas Tech. They led from wire to wire to Allen Fieldhouse earlier this month, and then held serve at home over the weekend by beating West Virginia.
So there's someone to really keep an eye on here.
Absolutely.
Okay. Turning to Missouri, they had two down-to-the-wire losses in SEC play. What's going on with the Tigers these days?
Well, the Tigers have to learn how to finish victories or what seems to be a victory in their grasp. They let another one slip away against Arkansas over the weekend after staging a tremendous comeback. And at home, they had a stinging loss against Florida when their guard had a ball stolen, and their backcourt is very young, as is the whole team. But Florida then stole the ball, went up for a layup with a last-second victory in Columbia. So they just have to finish games.
You know, Mizzou fans know there's been so much attention paid to the addition of Michael Porter Jr. This year. But there's another story in Columbia that is worth talking about, too. Tell us about that one.
And that's the MU women's team.
Mm.
A very good team. It may be MU's best ever.
Huh.
They have only two losses this year. A Porter influence there, too. Two Porters are on the women's team, Bree and Sierra.
Wow.
One of them starts, one of
they're
them...
They're not related, though, are they?
Yeah, they're the sisters of Michael and Jonte.
They're all over the place.
They are all over the place. And they have a chance, as I mentioned, to be the best ever. And we have a regional here in Kansas City. And in the NCAA, you have 16 first-round sites. Mizzou is positioning itself to host the first weekend and then may be in a position, depending on how the bracketing goes, to come to Kansas City to play the second weekend if they get that far.
So is the Mizzou women's team ranked nationally?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They have only two losses this year, one at home against LSU and the other on a neutral court to open the season against Western Kentucky. The win that really raised eyebrows is a home victory over the defending NCAA champions, South Carolina, which is still a top 10 ranked team this year.
So this team obviously has tournament hopes that are on the high side then.
Oh, absolutely. The sky's the limit. What's interesting about the women's game is, and at MU in particular, is for all the interest and the success that MU has, they still need to draw more fans there. They have not surpassed 5,000 fans for their home games in Columbia this year.
Okay, big prediction here. Is KU men's team, is this team going to repeat as Big 12 champs this year, or is this the year the streak finally gets broken?
I'm not optimistic in regards to KU. I thought at the beginning of the season they had the makings of being a really good team, but I think the other teams have caught them, so I'm going to go out on a limb and say that this is the year that they don't.
Okay, we'll leave it there. That's KCUR sports contributor Greg Eklund. Greg, always good to have you here. Thanks very much.
You're welcome, Steve.
Well, last week on the program, we got the latest on Kansas and Missouri politics. We met a local woman who hiked from Georgia to Maine on the Appalachian Trail, all 2,000 miles of it, and we listened to the best music in Kansas City from last year. Those conversations and all of our previous programs and podcasts are at kcur.org/up-to-date. You can find us on Twitter. We're at kcurupto-date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske, and don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow I speak with jazz pianist Marcus Roberts, whose trio will play the Folly Theater this weekend. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Kathleen Pointer. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.